Think I have forgotten how it felt to be afraid? Whitebeard bowed his head. Your Grace, I did not mean to give offence. Only lies offend me, and never honest counsel. Danny patted Arston's spotted hand to reassure him. I have a dragon's temper, that's all. You must not let it frighten you.
I shall try and remember, Whitebeard smiled.
He has a good face and great strength to him, Danny thought. She could not understand why Ser Jorah mistrusted the old man so. Could he be jealous that I have found another man to talk to? Unbidden, her thoughts went back to the night on Beleriand when the exiled knight had kissed her. He should never have done that. He is thrice my age, and too low a birth for me. And I never gave him leave. No true knight would ever kiss a queen without her leave. She had taken care never to be alone with Ser Jorah after that, keeping her handmaids with her aboard ship, and sometimes her blood riders. He wants to kiss me again. I see it in his eyes. What Danny wanted, she could not begin to say, but Jorah's kiss had woken something in her, something that had been sleeping since Khal Drogo died. Lying abed in her narrow bunk, she found herself wondering how it would be to have a man squeezed in beside her in place of her handmaid, and the thought was more exciting than it should have been. Sometimes she would close her eyes and dream of him, but it was never Jorah Mormont she dreamed of. Her lover was always younger and more comely, though his face remained a shifting shadow. Once, so tormented she could not sleep, Danny slid a hand down between her legs and gasped when she felt how wet she was. Scarce daring to breathe, she moved her fingers back and forth between her lower lips, slowly so as not to wake Eerie beside her, until she found one sweet spot and lingered there, touching herself lightly, timidly at first, and then faster. Still, the relief she wanted seemed to recede before her, until her dragon stirred, and one screamed out across the cabin, and Eerie woke and saw what she was doing. Danny knew her face was flushed, but in the darkness Eerie surely could not tell. Wordless, the handmaid put a hand on her breast, then bent to take a nipple in her mouth. The other hand drifted down across the soft curve of belly, through the mound of fine silvery gold hair, and went to work between Danny's thighs. It was no more than a few moments until her legs twisted and her breasts heaved and her whole body shuddered. She screamed then. Or perhaps that was Drogon. Eerie never said a thing, only curled back up and went back to sleep, the instant the thing was done. The next day it all seemed a dream. And what did Ser Jorah have to do with it, if anything? It is Drogo I want, my sun and stars, Danny reminded herself. Not Eerie, not Ser Jorah, only Drogo. Drogo was dead, though. She thought those feelings had died with him, there in the red waste. But one treacherous kiss had somehow brought them back to life. He should never have kissed me. He presumed too much, and I permitted it. It must never happen again. She set her mouth grimly and gave her head a shake, and the bell in her braid chimed softly. Closer to the bay, the city presented a fairer face. The great brick pyramids lined the shore, the largest 400 feet high. All manner of trees and vines and flowers grew on their broad terraces, and the winds that swirled around them smelled green and fragrant. Another gigantic harpy stood atop the gate, this one made of baked red clay and crumbling visibly, with no more than a stub of her scorpion's tail remaining. The chain she grasped in her clay claws was old iron, rotten with rust. It was cooler down by the water, though. The lapping of the waves against the rotting pilings made a curiously soothing sound. Aego helped Danny down from her litter. Strong Belwas was seated on a massive piling, eating a great haunch of brown roasted meat. "Dog," he said happily, when he saw Danny. "Good doggy, Master Boar, little queen. Eat!" He offered it with a greasy grin. "That is kind of you, Belwas, but no." Danny had eaten dog in other places at other times, but just now all she could think of was the Unsullied and their stupid puppies. She swept past the huge eunuch and up the plank onto the deck of Beleriand. Sir Jorah Mormont stood waiting for her.
"Your Grace," he said, bowing his head, "the slavers have come and gone. Three of them, with a dozen scribes, and as many slaves to lift and fetch. They crawled over every foot of our holds and made note of all we had."
He walked her aft.
"How many men do they have for sale?"
"None." Was it Mormont she was angry with, or this city with its sullen heat, its stinks and sweats and crumbling bricks? "They sell eunuchs, not men. Eunuchs made of brick, like the rest of Astapor. Shall I buy 8,000 brick eunuchs with dead eyes that never move, who kill suckling babes for the sake of a spiked hat and strangle their own dogs? They don't even have names, so don't call them men, sir."
"Khaleesi," he said, taken aback by her fury, "the Unsullied are chosen as boys and trained."
"I have heard all that I care to hear of their training." Danny could feel tears welling in her eyes, sudden and unwanted. Her hand flashed up and cracked Sir Jorah hard across the face. It was either that or cry. Mormont touched the cheek she had slapped.
"If I have displeased my queen..."
"You have. You've displeased me greatly, sir. If you were my true knight, you would never have brought me to this vile sty."
"If you were my true knight, you would never have kissed me, or looked at my breast the way you did, or—" "As your Grace commands, I shall tell Captain Grolio to make ready to sail on the evening tide for some sty less vile."
"No," said Danny. Grolio watched them from the forecastle, and his crew was watching too. Whitebeard, her blood riders, Jiqui, everyone had stopped what they were doing at the sound of the slap. "I want to sail now. Not on the tide. I want to sail far and fast and never look back. But I can't, can I? There are 8,000 brick eunuchs for sale, and I must find some way to buy them." And with that she left him and went below. Behind the carved wooden door of the captain's cabin, her dragons were restless. Drogon raised his head and screamed, pale smoke venting from his nostrils. And Viserion flapped at her and tried to perch on her shoulder, as he had when he was smaller. "No," Danny said, trying to shrug him off gently. "You're too big for that now, sweetling." But the dragon coiled his white and gold tail around one arm and dug black claws into the fabric of her sleeve, clinging tightly. Helpless, she sank into Grolio's great leather chair, giggling. "They have been wild while you were gone, Khaleesi," Eri told her. "Viserion clawed splinters from the door, do you see? And Drogon made to escape when the slaver men came to see them. When I grabbed his tail to hold him back, he turned and bit me." She showed Danny the marks of his teeth on her hand. Did any of them try to burn their way free? That was the thing that frightened Danny the most. "No, Khaleesi. Drogon breathed his fire, but in the empty air. The slaver men feared to come near him." She kissed Iri's hand where Drogon had bitten it. "I'm sorry he hurt you. Dragons are not meant to be locked up in a small ship's cabin." "Dragons are like horses in this," Iri said, "and riders too. The horses scream below, Khaleesi, and kick at the wooden walls. I hear them. And Jiqui says the old women and the little ones scream too when you are not here. They do not like this water cart. They do not like the black salt sea."
"I know," Danny said. "I do, I know."
"My Khaleesi is sad?"
"Yes," Danny admitted. "Sad and lost."
"Should I pleasure the Khaleesi?" Danny stepped away from her. "No, Eri, you do not need to do that. What happened that night when you woke? You're no bed slave. I freed you, remember? You—I am handmaid to the Mother of Dragons. the girl said. It is great honour to please my Khaleesi.
I don't want that, she insisted. I don't. She turned away sharply. Leave me now. I want to be alone, to think.
Dusk had begun to settle over the waters of Slaver's Bay before Danny returned to the deck. She stood by the rail and looked out over Astapor. From here it looks almost beautiful, she thought. The stars were coming out above and the silk lanterns below, just as Krasny's translator had promised. The brick pyramids were all glimmery with light. But it is dark below, in the streets and plazas and fighting pits, and it is the darkest of all in the barracks, where some little boy is feeding scraps to the puppy they gave him when they took away his manhood. There was a soft step behind her.
Khaleesi!
His voice.
Might I speak frankly?
Danny did not turn. She could not bear to look at him just now. If she did, she might well slap him again, or cry, or kiss him, and never know which was right, and which was wrong, and which was madness.
Say what you will, sir. When Aegon the Dragon stepped ashore in Westeros, the kings of Vale and Rock and Reach did not rush to hand him their crowns. If you mean to sit his iron throne, you must win it as he did, with steel and dragonfire. And that will mean blood on your hands before the thing is done.
Blood and fire, thought Danny. The words of House Targaryen. She had known them all her life. The blood of my enemies I will shed gladly. The blood of innocents is another matter. 8,000 unsullied they would offer me. 8,000 dead babies. 8,000 strangled dogs.
Your Grace, said Jorah Mormont, I saw King's Landing after the sack. Babes were butchered that day as well, and old men and children at play. More women were raped than you can count. There's a savage beast in every man, and when you hand that man a sword or spear and send him forth to war, the beast stirs. The scent of blood is all it takes to wake him. Yet I've never heard of these unsullied raping, nor putting a city to the sword, nor even plundering, save at the express command of those who led them. Bricks they may be, as you say, but if you buy them henceforth, the only dogs they'll kill are those you want dead. And you do have some dogs you want dead, as I recall.
The usurper's dogs. Yes. Danny gazed off at the soft-coloured lights and let the cool salt breeze caress her. You speak of sacking cities. Answer me this, sir. Why have the Dothraki never sacked this city? She pointed. Look at the walls. You can see where they've begun to crumble. There and there. Do you see any guards on those towers? I don't. Are they hiding, sir? I saw these sons of the Harpy today, all their proud high-born warriors. They dressed in linen skirts, and the fiercest thing about them was their hair. Even a modest Khalasar could crack this Astapor like a nut and spill out the rotted meat inside. So tell me, why is that ugly harpy not sitting beside the god's way in Vaes Dothrak, among the other stolen gods?
You have a dragon's eye, Khaleesi. That's plain to see.
I wanted an answer, not a compliment.
There are two reasons. Astapor's brave defenders are so much chaff, it's true. Old names and fat purses who dress up as Gascari scourges to pretend they still rule a vast empire. Everyone is a high officer. On feast days, they fight mock wars in the pits to demonstrate what brilliant commanders they are. But it's the eunuchs who do the dying. All the same, any enemy wanting to sack Astapor would have to know that they'd be facing the unsullied. The slavers would turn out the whole garrison in the city's defence. The Dothraki have not ridden against unsullied since they left their braids at the gates of Kohor.
And the second reason? Danny asked.
Who would attack Astapor? Sir Jorah asked. Meereen and Yunkai are rivals, but not enemies. The Doom destroyed Valeria. The folk of the eastern hinterlands are all Giscari, and beyond the hills lies Lazar, the Lamb Men, as your Dothraki call them, and notably unwarlike people. Yes, she agreed, but north of the slave cities is the Dothraki Sea, and 24 mighty Karls who like nothing more than sacking cities and carrying off their people into slavery. Carrying them off where? What good are slaves once you've killed the slavers? Valeria is no more. Karth lies beyond the Red Waste, and the 9 free cities are thousands of leagues to the west. And you may be sure, the sons of the Harpy give lavishly to every passing Karl, just as the magisters do in Pentos and Norvas and Myr. They know that if they feast the horse lords and give them gifts, they will soon ride on. It's cheaper than fighting, and a deal more certain.
Cheaper than fighting, Danny thought. Yes, it might be. If only it could be that easy for her. How pleasant it would be to sail to King's Landing with her dragons and pay the boy Joffrey a chest of gold to make him go away. Khaleesi, Ser Jorah prompted, when she had been silent for a long time. He touched her elbow lightly. Danny shrugged him off. Viserys would have bought as many Unsullied as he had coin for. But you once said I was like Rhaegar. I remember, Daenerys. Your grace, she corrected. Prince Rhaegar led free men into battle, not slaves. Whitebeard said he dubbed his squires himself, and made many other knights as well. There was no higher honour than to receive your knighthood from the Prince of Dragonstone. Tell me, then, when he touched a man on the shoulder with his sword, what did he say? Go forth and kill the weak, or go forth and defend them. At the Trident, those brave men Viserys spoke of, who died beneath our dragon banners, did they give their lives because they believed in Rhaegar's cause, or because they had been bought and paid for? Danny turned to Mormont, crossed her arms, and waited for an answer.
My queen, the big man said slowly, all you say is true. But Rhaegar lost on the Trident. He lost the battle. He lost the war. He lost the kingdom. And he lost his life. His blood swirled downriver with the rubies from his breastplate, and Robert the Usurper rode over his corpse to steal the Iron Throne. Rhaegar fought valiantly. Rhaegar fought nobly. Rhaegar fought honorably. And Rhaegar died.
John. A blowing rain lashed at John's face as he spurred his horse across the swollen stream. Beside him, Lord Commander Mormont gave the hood of his cloak a tug, muttering curses on the weather. His raven sat on his shoulder, feathers ruffled, as soaked and grumpy as the old bear himself. A gust of wind sent wet leaves flapping around them like a flock of dead birds. The haunted forest, John thought ruefully. The drowned forest, more like it. He hoped Sam was holding up, back down the column. He was not a good rider, even in fair weather, and 6 days of rain had made the ground treacherous, all soft mud and hidden rocks. When the wind blew, it drove the water right into their eyes. The wall would be flowing off to the south, the melting ice mingling with warm rain to wash down in sheets and rivers. Pip and Toad would be sitting near the fire in the common room, drinking cups of mulled wine before their supper. John envied them. His wet wool clung to him, sodden and itching. His neck and shoulders ached fiercely from the weight of mail and sword, and he was sick of salt cud, salt beef, and hard cheese. Up ahead, a hunting horn sounded a quavering note, half drowned beneath the constant patter of the rain. Buckwell's horn, the old bear announced. The guards are good. Craster's still there. His raven gave a single flap of his big wings, croaked, "Corn!" and ruffled his feathers up again. John had often heard his black brothers tell tales of Cresta and his keep. Now he would see it with his own eyes. After 7 empty villages, they had all come to dread finding Cresta's as dead and desolate as the rest. But it seemed they would be spared that. "Perhaps the old bear will finally get some answers," he thought. "Anyway, we'll be out of the rain." Thorin Smallwood swore that Cresta was a friend to the Watch, despite his unsavoury reputation. "The man's half mad, I won't deny it," he told the old bear. "But you'd be the same if you spent your life in this cursed wood. Even so, he's never turned a ranger away from his fire, nor does he love Mance Rayder. He'll give us good counsel."
"So long as he gives us a hot meal and a chance to dry our clothes, I'll be happy." Dywin said Cresta was a kingslayer, liar, raper, and craven, and hinted that he trafficked with slavers and demons.
"And worse," the old forester would add, clacking his wooden teeth. "There's a cold smell to that one, there is." "John," Lord Mormont commanded, "ride back along the column and spread the word. And remind the officers that I want no trouble about Cresta's wives. The men are to mind their hands and speak to these women as little as need be."
"Aye, my lord." John turned his horse back the way they'd come. It was pleasant to have the rain out of his face, if only for a little while. Everyone he passed seemed to be weeping. The march was strung out through 1/2 mile of woods. In the midst of the baggage train, John passed Samwell Tarley, slumped in his saddle under a wide, floppy hat. He was riding one dray horse and leading the others. The drumming of the rain against the hoods of their cages had the ravens squawking and fluttering. "You put a fox in with them?" John called out. Rain ran off the brim of Sam's hat as he lifted his head.
"Oh, hello, John. No, they just hate the rain, same as us."
"How are you faring, Sam?"
"Wetly," the fat boy managed to smile. "Nothing has killed me yet, though."
"Good. Cresta's keep is just ahead. If the guards are good, he'll let us sleep by his fire." Sam looked dubious.
"Dolorous Head said Craster's a terrible savage. He marries his daughters and obeys no laws but those he makes himself. And Dywin told Gren he's got black blood in his veins. His mother was a wildling woman who lay with a ranger. So he's a bast—"
Suddenly he realized what he was about to say. "A bastard," John said with a laugh. "You can say it, Sam. I've heard the word before." He put his spurs into his sure-footed little garron. "I need to hunt down Sir Utin. Be careful around Cresta's women." As if Samwell Tarley needed warning on that score. "We'll talk later, after we've made camp." John carried the word back to Sir Utin Withers, plodding along with the rear guard. A small prune-faced man, of an age with Mormont, Sir Utin always looked tired, even at Castle Black, and the rain had beaten him down unmercifully.
"Welcome, tidings," he said. "This wet has soaked my bones, and even my saddle sores complain of saddle sores."
On his way back, John swung wide of the column's line of march and took a shorter path through the thick of the wood. The sounds of man and horse diminished, swallowed up by the wet green wild, and soon enough he could hear only the steady wash of rain against leaf and tree and rock. It was mid-afternoon, yet the forest seemed as dark as dusk. John wove a path between rocks and puddles, past great oaks, grey-green sentinels, and black-barked ironwoods. In places, the branches wove a canopy overhead, and he was given a moment's respite from the drumming of the rain against his head. As he rode past a lightning-blasted chestnut tree overgrown with wild white roses, he heard something rustling in the undergrowth. "Ghost?" he called out. "Ghost! To me!" But it was Dywin who emerged from the greenery, forking a shaggy grey garron with Gren, a horse, beside him. The old bear had deployed outriders to either side of the main column to screen their march and warn of the approach of any enemies, and even there he took no chances, sending the men out in pairs.
"Oh, it's you, Lord Snow."
Dywin smiled, an oaken smile. His teeth were carved of wood and fit badly.
"Thought me and the boy, Alice, one of them others to deal with. Lost your wolf?"
"He's off hunting." Ghost did not like to travel with the column, but he would not be far. When they made camp for the night, he'd find his way to John at the Lord Commander's tent.
"Fishing, I call it, in this wet," Dywin said. "My mother always said rain was good for growing crops,"
Gren put in hopefully.
"Aye, a good crop of mildew," Dywin said. "The best thing about a rain like this, it saves a man from taking baths."
He made a clacking sound on his wooden teeth. "Buckwolves found Craster," John told them.
"And he lost him," Dywin chuckled. "See that your young butts don't go nosing about Craster's wives, you hear?"
John smiled. "Want them all for yourself, Dywin?" Dywin clacked his teeth some more.
"Might be I do. Craster's got 10 fingers and 1 cock, and he don't count but to 11. He'd never miss a couple."
"How many wives does he have, truly?"
Gren asked.
"More than you ever will, brother. Well, it's not so hard when you breed your own. There's your beast, Snow."
Ghost was trotting along beside John's horse with tail held high, his white fur ruffled up thick against the rain. He moved so silently, John could not have said just when he appeared. Gren's mount shied at the scent of him, even now, after more than a year. The horses were uneasy in the presence of the dire wolf. "With me, Ghost!" John spurred off to Craster's keep. He had never thought to find a stone castle on that far side of the wall, but he had pictured some sort of mott and bailey, with a wooden palisade and a timber tower keep. What they found instead was a midden heap, a pigsty, an empty sheepfold, and a windowless daub and wattle hall scarce worthy of the name. It was long and low, chinked together from logs and roofed with sod. The compound stood atop a rise, too modest to name a hill, surrounded by an earthen dike. Brown rivulets flowed down the slope where the rain had eaten gaping holes in the defences to join a rushing brook that curved around to the north, its thick waters turned into a murky torrent by the rains. On the southwest he found an open gate flanked by a pair of animal skulls on high poles, a bear to one side, a ram to the other. Bits of flesh still clung to the bear skull, John noted as he joined the line riding past. Within, Jarman Buckwell's scouts and men from Thorin Smallwood's van were setting up horse lines and struggling to raise tents. A host of piglets rooted about 3 huge sows in the sty. Nearby, a small girl pulled carrots from a garden, naked in the rain, while 2 women tied a pig for slaughter. The animal's squeals were high and horrible, almost human in their distress. Chet's hounds barked wildly in answer, snarling and snapping despite his curses, with a pair of Craster's dogs barking back. When they saw a ghost, some of the dogs broke off and ran, while others began to bay and growl. The dire wolf ignored them, as did John. "Well, 30 of us will be warm and dry," John thought, once he'd gotten a good look at the hall. "Perhaps as many as 50. The place was much too small to sleep 200 men, so most would need to remain outside. And where to put them? The rain had turned half the compound yard to ankle-deep puddles, and the rest to sucking mud. Another dismal night was in prospect. The Lord Commander had entrusted his mount to Dolorous Ed. He was cleaning mud out of the horse's hooves as John dismounted.
"Lord Mormont's in the hall," he announced. "He said for you to join him, eh?
Best leave the wolf outside. He looks hungry enough to eat one of Craster's children, eh? Well, truth be told, I'm hungry enough to eat one of Craster's children, so long as he was served hot, eh? Go on, I'll sit your horse. If it's warm and dry inside, eh, don't tell me. I wasn't asked in. He flicked a glob of wet mud out from under a horseshoe. Does this mud look like shit to you? Could it be the old ill is made of Craster's shit, eh?
John smiled. Well, I hear he's been here a long time.
You cheer me, nut. Go and see the old bear, eh?
Go stay, he commanded. The door to Craster's keep was made of two flaps of deer hide. John shoved between them, stooping to pass under the low lintel. Two dozen of the chief rangers had preceded him and were standing around the fire pit in the centre of the dirt floor while puddles collected about their boots. The hall stank of soot, dung, and wet dog. The air was heavy with smoke, yet somehow still damp. Rain leaked through the smoke hole in the roof. It was all a single room, with a sleeping loft above, reached by a pair of splintery ladders. John remembered how he felt the day they had left the wall, nervous as a maiden, but eager to glimpse the mysteries and wonders beyond each new horizon. Well, here's one of the wonders, he told himself, gazing about the squalid, foul-smelling hall. The acrid smoke was making his eyes water. A pity that Pip and Toad can't see all they're missing. Craster sat above the fire, the only man to enjoy his own chair. Even Lord Commander Mormont must seat himself on the common bench, with his raven muttering on his shoulder. Jarman Buckwell stood behind, dripping from patch mail and shiny wet leather, beside Thorin Smallwood in the late Sir Jeremy's heavy breastplate and sable-trimmed cloak. Craster's sheepskin jerkin and cloak of sewn skins made a shabby contrast, but around one thick wrist was a heavy ring that had the glint of gold. He looked to be a powerful man, though well into the winter of his days now, his mane of grey hair growing to white. A flat nose and a drooping moustache gave him a cruel look, and one of his ears was missing. So this is a wildling. John remembered old Nan's tales of the savage folk who drank blood from human skulls. Craster seemed to be drinking a thin yellow beer from a chipped stone cup. Perhaps he had not heard the stories.
I've not seen Benjen Stark for 3 years, he was telling Mormont, and if truth be told, I never once missed him.
A half-dozen black puppies and the odd pig or two skulked among the benches, while women in ragged deerskins passed horns of beer, stirred the fire, and chopped carrots and onions into a kettle.
He ought to have passed here last year, said Thorin Smallwood.
A dog came sniffing around his leg. He kicked it and sent it off yipping. Lord Mormont said,
Ben was searching for Sir Waymar Royce, who'd vanished with Garrod and young Will.
I and those three, I recall. The lordling not older than one of these pups, too proud to sleep under my roof, him in his sable cloak and black steel. My wives give him big cow eyes all the same.
He turned his squint on the nearest of the women.
Garrod says they were chasing raiders. I told him, with a commander that green, best not catch him. Garrod wasn't half bad, for a crow. Had less ears than me, that one. The bite took him, same as mine. Craster laughed. Now I hear he got no head, neither. The bite'll do that, too.
John remembered a spray of red blood on white snow and the way Theon Greyjoy had kicked the dead man's head. The man was a deserter. On the way back to Winterfell, John and Rob had raced and found 6 direwolf pups in the snow. 1,000 years ago. When Sir Waymar left you, where was he bound? Craster gave a shrug.
happens I have better things to do than tend to the comings and goings of crows."
He drank a pull of beer and set the cup aside.
"Had no good Southern wine up here for a bear's night. I could use me some wine and a new axe. Mine's lost its bite. Can't have that. I got me women to protect."
He gazed around at his scurrying wives.
"You are few here and isolated," Mormont said. "If you like, I'll detail some men to escort you south to the wall."
The raven seemed to like the notion.
"Wall,"
it screamed, spreading black wings like a high collar behind Mormont's head. The host gave a nasty smile, showing a mouthful of broken brown teeth.
"And what would we do there? Serve you at supper? We're free folk here. Craster serves no man." "These are bad times to dwell alone in the wild. The cold winds are rising." "Let them rise. My roots are sunk deep."
Craster grabbed a passing woman by the wrist.
"Tell him, wife. Tell the Lord Crow how well content we are."
The woman licked at thin lips.
"This is our place. Craster keeps us safe. Better to die free than live a slave."
"Slave,"
muttered the raven. Mormont leaned forward.
"Every village we have passed has been abandoned. Yours are the first living faces we have seen since we left the wall. The people are gone, whether dead, fled, or taken, I could not say. The animals as well, nothing is left. And earlier we found the bodies of two of Ben Stark's rangers only a few leagues from the wall. They were pale and cold, with black hands and black feet, and wounds that did not bleed. Yet when we took them back to Castle Black, they rose in the night and killed. One slew Sir Jeremy Riker, and the other came for me, which tells me that they remember some of what they knew when they lived. But there was no human mercy left in them."
The woman's mouth hung open, a wet pink cave. But Craster only gave a snort.
"We've had no such troubles here, and I'll thank you not to tell such evil tales under my roof. I'm a godly man, and the gods keep me safe. If whites come walking, I'll know how to send them back to their graves, though I could use me a sharp new axe."
He sent his wives scurrying with a slap on her leg and a shout of,
"More beer, and be quick about it."
"No trouble from the dead,"
Jarman Buckle said.
"But what of the living, my lord? What of your king?"
"King,"
cried Mormont's raven.
"King, king, king."
"That Mance Raider,"
Craster spit into the fire.
"King beyond the wall. What do free folk want with kings?"
He turned his squint on Mormont.
"There's much I could tell you, a raider and his doings, if I had a mind. This of the empty villages, that's his work. You would have found this hall abandoned as well, if I were a man to scrape to such. He sends a rider, tells me I must leave my own keep to come grovel at his feet. I sent the man back, but kept his tongue. It's nailed to that wall there,"
he pointed.
"Might be I could tell you where to seek Mance Raider, if I had a mind."
The brown smile again.
"But we'll have time enough for that. You'll be wanting to sleep beneath my roof, belike, and eat me out of pigs."
"A roof would be most welcome, my lord," Mormont said. "We've had hard riding and too much wet."
"Then you'll be guest here for a night. No longer. I'm not that fond of crows. The loft's for me and mine, but you'll have all the floor you like. I've meat and beer for 20, no more. The rest of your black crows can peck after their own corn."
"We've pecked in our own supplies, my lord," said the old bear. "We should be pleased to share our food and wine.
Craster wiped his drooping mouth with the back of a hairy hand.
"I'll taste your wine, Lord Crow, that I will. One more thing. Any man lays a hand on my wives, he loses the hand."
Your rule, said Thorin Smallwood, and Lord Mormont nodded stiffly, though he looked none too pleased.
"That's settled, then."
Craster grudged them a grunt.
"Do you have a man can draw a map?"
"Sam Tarley can," John pushed forward. "Sam loves maps." Mormont beckoned him closer.
"Send him here after he's eaten. Have him bring quill and parchment. And find Tollet as well. Tell him to bring an axe. A guest gift for our host." "Who's this one now?"
Craster said before John could go.
"He has the look of a Stark. My steward and squire, John Snow." "A bastard, is it?"
Craster looked John up and down.
"Man wants to bed a woman. Seems like he ought to take her to wife. That's what I'd do."
He shooed John off with a wave.
"Well, run and do your service, bastard, and see that axe is good and sharp now. I've no use for dull steel."
John Snow bowed stiffly and took his leave. Sir Otin Withers was coming in as he was leaving, and they almost collided at the deerhide door. Outside, the rain seemed to have slackened. Tents had gone up all over the compound. John could see the tops of others under the trees. Dolores Ed was feeding the horses.
"Call give the wilding an axe, why not, eh?"
He pointed out Mormont's weapon, a short-hafted battle-axe with gold scrollwork inlaid on the black steel blade.
"He'll give it back, I vow, buried in the old bear's skull, eh? Like as not. Why not give him all our axes and our swords as well, eh? I mislike the way they clank and rattle as we ride. We'll travel faster, eh, without 'em? Straight to hell's door. Does it rain in hell, I wonder? Eh? Perhaps Craster would like a nice hat instead, eh?"
John smiled. "He wants an axe and wine as well."
"See, the old bear's clever, eh? If we get the wildling well and truly drunk, eh, perhaps he'll only cut off an ear when he tries to slay us with that axe. I have 2 ears, but only 1 ear, eh?"
Smallwood said Craster is a friend to the Watch.
"Do you know the difference between a wildling who's a friend to the Watch and one who's not, eh?" asked the Dour Squire. "Our enemies leave our bodies for the crows, eh, and the wolves. Our friends bury us in secret graves. I wonder how long that bear's been nailed up on that gate, and what Craster had there before we came hallooing, eh?"
Ed looked at the axe doubtfully, the rain running down his long face.
"Is it dry in there, eh?"
"Drier than out here."
"If I look about, eh, not too close to the fire, belike they'll take no note of me till morning, eh? The ones under his roof will be the first he murders, but at least we'll die dry, eh?"
John had to laugh. "Craster's one man. We're 200. I doubt he'll murder anyone."
"You cheer me," said Ed, sounding utterly morose. "And besides, there's much to be said for a good sharp axe. I'd hate to be murdered with a maul. I saw a man hit in the brow with a maul once, eh? Scarce split the skin at all. But his head turned mushy and swelled up big as a gourd, only purply red, eh? A comely man, but he died ugly, eh? It's good that we're not giving them mauls."
Ed walked away, shaking his head, his sudden black cloak shedding rain behind him. John got the horses fed before he stopped to think of his own supper. He was wondering where to find Sam when he heard a shout of fear. "Wolf!" He sprinted round the hall towards the cry, the earth sucking at his boots. One of Craster's women was backed up against the mud-spattered wall of the keep.
"Keep away!" she was shouting at Ghost. "You keep away!"
The direwolf had a rabbit in his mouth and another dead and bloody on the ground before him.
"Get it away, my lord," she pleaded when she saw him.
"He won't hurt you." He knew at once what had happened. A wooden hutch, its slats shattered, lay on its side in the wet grass. "He must have been hungry. We haven't seen much game." John whistled. The dire wolf bolted down the rabbit, crunching the small bones between his teeth, and padded over to him. The woman regarded them with nervous eyes. She was younger than he'd thought at first. A girl of 15 or 16 years, he judged. Dark hair, plastered across a gaunt face by the falling rain. Her bare feet muddy to the ankles. The body under the sewn skins was showing in the early turns of pregnancy. "Are you one of Craster's daughters?" he asked. She put a hand over her belly. "Wife now." Edging away from the wolf, she knelt mournfully beside the broken hutch. "I was going to breed them rabbits. There's no sheep left." "The watch will make good for them." John had no coin of his own, or he would have offered it to her, though he was not sure what good a few coppers or even a silver piece would do her beyond the wall. "I'll speak to Lord Mormont on the morrow." She wiped her hands on her skirt. "My lord?" "I'm no lord." But others had come crowding round, drawn by the woman's scream and the crash of the rabbit hutch.
"Don't you believe him, girl?"
called out Lark, the sister man, a ranger mean as a cur.
"That's Lord Snow himself."
"Bastard of Winterfell and brother to kings," mocked Chet, who left his hounds to see what the commotion was about.
"That wolf's looking at you hungry, girl," Lark said. "Might be it fancies that tender bit in your belly."
John was not amused. "You're scaring her." "Warning her, more like." Chet's grin was as ugly as the boils that covered most of his face. "We're not to talk to you," the girl remembered suddenly. "Wait," John said, too late. She bolted, ran. Lark made a grab for the second rabbit, but Ghost was quicker. When he bared his teeth, the sister man slipped in the mud and went down on his bony butt. The others laughed. The direwolf took the rabbit in his mouth and brought it to John. "There was no call to scare the girl," he told them.
"We'll hear no scolds from you, bastard."
Chet blamed John for the loss of his comfortable position with Maester Aemon, and not without justice. If he had not gone to Aemon about Sam Tarley, Chet would still be tending an old blind man instead of a pack of ill-tempered hunting hounds. "You may be the Lord Commander's pet, but you're not the Lord Commander, and you wouldn't talk so bloody bold without that monster of yours always about." "I'll not fight a brother while we're beyond the wall," John answered, his voice cooler than he felt. Lark got to one knee.
"He's afraid of you, Chet. On the sisters, we have a name for them like him."
"I know all the names. Save your breath." He walked away, Ghost at his side. The rain had dwindled to a thin drizzle by the time he reached the gate. Dusk would be on them soon, followed by another wet, dark, dismal night. The clouds would hide moon and stars and Mormont's torch, turning the woods black as pitch. Every piss would be an adventure, if not quite of the sort Jon Snow had once envisioned. Out under the trees, some rangers had found enough duff and dry wood to start a fire beneath a slanting ridge of slate. Others had raised tents or made crude shelters by stretching their cloaks over low branches. Giant had crammed himself inside the hollow of a dead oak.
"How do you like my castle, Lord Snow?"
"It looks snug. You know where Sam is?"
"Keep on the way you were. If you come to Sir Otten's pavilion, you've gone too far."
Giant smiled.
"Unless Sam's found him a tree, too. What a tree that would be."
It was Ghost who found Sam in the end. The direwolf shot ahead like a quarrel from a crossbow. Under an outcrop of rock that gave some small degree of shelter from the rain, Sam was feeding the ravens. His boots squished as he moved.
"My feet are soaked through," he admitted miserably. "When I climbed off my horse, I stepped in a hole,
and went in up to my knees. Won't you be attending Lord Mormont in the hall?
No, but you will. The old bear wants you to map for him. Craster says he'll find Mance Raider for us.
Oh! Sam did not look anxious to meet Craster, even if it meant a warm fire.
He said, eat first, though. Dry your feet.
John went to gather fuel, digging down under deadfalls from the drier wood beneath, and peeling back layers of sudden pine needles until he found likely kindling. Even then, it seemed to take forever for a spark to catch. He hung his cloak from the rock to keep the rain off his smoky little fire, making them a small, snug alcove. As he knelt to skin the rabbit, Sam pulled off his boots.
"I think there's musk growing between my toes," he declared mournfully, wriggling the toes in question. "The rabbit will taste good. I don't even mind about the blood and all." He looked away. "Well, only a little."
John spit at the carcass, banked the fire with a pair of rocks, and balanced their meal atop them. The rabbit had been a scrawny thing, but as it cooked, it smelt like a king's feast. Other rangers gave them envious looks. Even Ghost looked up hungrily, flames shining in his red eyes as he sniffed.
"You had yours before," John reminded him.
"Is Craster as savage as the rangers say?" Sam asked.
The rabbit was a shade underdone, but tasted wonderful.
"What's his castle like?"
"A midden heap, with a roof and a fire pit," John told Sam what he had seen and heard in Craster's keep. By the time the telling was done, it was dark outside, and Sam was licking his fingers.
"That was good, and now I'd like a leg of lamb. A whole leg just for me, sauce with mint and honey and cloves. Did you see any lambs?"
"There was a sheepfold, but no sheep."
"How does he feed all his men?"
"I didn't see any men, just Craster and his women, and a few small girls. I wonder he's able to hold the place. His defences were nothing to speak about, only a muddy dike. You'd better go up to the hall and draw that map. Can you find the way?"
"If I don't fall in the mud."
Sam struggled back into his boots, collected quill and parchment, and shouldered out into the night, the rain pattering down on his cloak and floppy hat. Ghost laid his head on his paws and went to sleep by the fire. John stretched out beside him, grateful for the warmth. He was cold and wet, but not so cold and wet as he had been a short time before. "Perhaps tonight the old bear will learn something that will lead us to Uncle Benjamin." He woke to the sight of his own breath misting in the cold morning air. When he moved, his bones ached. Ghost was gone. The fire burnt out. John reached to pull aside the cloak he'd hung over the rock and found it stiff and frozen. He crept beneath it and stood up in a forest turned to crystal. The pale pink light of dawn sparkled on branch and leaf and stone. Every blade of grass was carved from emerald, every drip of water turned to diamond. Flowers and mushrooms alike wore coats of glass. Even the mud puddles had a bright brown sheen. Through the shimmering greenery, the black tents of his brothers were encased in a fine glaze of ice. "So there is magic beyond the wall, after all." He found himself thinking of his sisters, perhaps because he'd dreamed of them last night. Sansa would call this an enchantment, and tears would fill her eyes at the wonder of it all. But Arya would run out laughing and shouting, wanting to touch it all.
"Lord Snow,"
he heard, soft and meek. He turned. Crouched atop the rock that had sheltered him during the night was the rabbit keeper, wrapped in a black cloak so large it drowned her. Sam's cloak, John realized at once. Why is she wearing Sam's cloak? "The fat one told me I'd find you here, my lord," she said.
"We ate the rabbit, if that's what you came for." The admission made him feel absurdly guilty.
Old Lord Crow, in with the talking bird, he gave Craster a crossbow worth 100 rabbits.
Her arms crossed over the swell of her belly.
"Is it true, my lord? Are you brother to a king?"
"A half-brother," he admitted. "I'm Ned Stark's bastard. My brother Rob is the king in the north."
"Why are you here?" "The fat one, that, Sam, he said to see you. He gave me his cloak, so no one would say I didn't belong."
"Won't Craster be angry with you?"
"My father drank overmuch of the Lord Crow's wine last night. He'll sleep most of the day."
Her breath frosted the air in small, nervous puffs.
"They say the king gives justice and protects the weak."
She started to climb off the rock awkwardly, but the ice had made it slippery, and her foot went out from under her. John caught her before she could fall, and helped her safely down. The woman knelt on the icy ground.
"My lord, I beg you."
"Don't beg me anything. Go back to your hall. You shouldn't be here. We were commanded not to speak to Craster's women."
"You don't have to speak with me, my lord. Just take me with you. When you go, that's all I ask." "All she asks," he thought, "as if that were nothing. I'll be your wife, if you like. My father, he's got 19 now. One less won't hurt him none."
"Black brothers are sworn never to take wives. Don't you know that? And we're guests in your father's hall, besides."
"Not you," she said. "I watched. You never ate at his board, nor slept by his fire. He never gave you guest right, so you're not bound to him. It's for the baby I have to go."
"I don't even know your name."
"Gilly, he called me, for the gilly flower."
"That's pretty." He remembered Sansa telling him once that he should say that whenever a lady told him her name. He could not help the girl, but perhaps the courtesy would please her. "Is it Craster who frightens you, Gilly?"
"For the baby, not for me. If it's a girl, that's not so bad. She'll grow a few years and he'll marry her. But Nella says if it's to be a boy, and she's had 6 and knows these things, he gives the boys to the guards. Come the white cold, he does. And of late it comes more often. That's why he started giving them sheep, even though he has a taste for mutton. Only now the sheep's gone too. Next it will be dogs till—"
She lowered her eyes and stroked her belly. "What guards?" John was remembering that they'd seen no boys in Craster's keep, nor men either, save Craster himself.
"The coal guards," she said, "the ones in the night, the white shadows."
And suddenly John was back in the Lord Commander's tower again. A severed hand was climbing his calf, and when he pried it off with the point of his longsword, it lay writhing, fingers opening and closing. The dead man rose to his feet, blue eyes shining in that gashed and swollen face. Ropes of torn flesh hung from the great wound in his belly, yet there was no blood. "What colour are their eyes?" he asked her.
"Blue, as bright as blue stars, and as cold."
"She has seen them," he thought. "Craster lied.
Will you take me just so far as the wall?"
"We do not ride for the wall. We ride north, after Mance Rayder and these others, these white shadows and their whites. We seek them, Gilly. Your babe would not be safe with us." Her fear was plain on her face.
"You will come back, though, when your warring's done. You'll pass this way again."
"We may, if any of us still live. That's for the old bear to say. The one you call the Lord Crow. I'm only his squire. I do not choose the road I ride."
"No," he could hear the defeat in her voice. "Sorry to be of trouble, my lord. I only... They said the king keeps people safe, and I thought..."
Despairing, she ran, Sam's cloak flapping behind her like great black wings. John watched her go, his joy in the morning's brittle beauty gone. "Damn her," he thought resentfully, "and damn Sam twice."